Hi everyone, my name's Cynthia Deeran and welcome to today's episode of the Business Beyond Borders podcast, where we unlock the secrets of international business. My guest today is Tony Jacobson, a sales and marketing guru who's originally from South Africa. Tony's worked with global brands around the world and his experience spans a really wide spectrum of the FMCG, retail, wristwatch, fashion accessory and IT industries. Tony loves to work with innovative companies who have great brands and great products, and he's worked with companies like the All Blacks and Speedo. Tony has also owned his own watch company that he turned into an international brand, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from him about that today. Tony, welcome to the show.
Morning, Cynthia. Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be here.
You're originally from South Africa. Tell me, what was your first foray into international business, and how did that actually happen?
Well, my first foray into international business was actually when I moved from South Africa to Australia. My business partner had a watch distribution company in South Africa, and we both had plans to immigrate to Australia. I moved ahead of him and set up the office in Sydney.
Yeah.
It was at that stage where we actually acquired the license from Speedo International to manufacture a range of watches under their brand, and we got the global rights for that watch license. So as I said, I set up the office in Sydney and then proceeded to get on my horse, as they say, and travel the world to meet distributors and, of course, suppliers.
And so it sounds like it was pretty deliberate as a plan.
Oh, yes.
You had it that mapped out.
It was a plan. My wife and I had always planned to move to Australia. And so this was a plan in the making for quite some time. Yeah.
And what was the motivation for starting a business that was international? What made you want to do this thing of getting a license and then having come all the way from South Africa, getting back on a plane and continuing to go all around the world? What was that about?
Well, we already had excellent experience in watch manufacturing because we used to make our own brands in South Africa, our own private label brands. Through various connections, we were introduced to Speedo. We approached them and managed to, you know, to negotiate an agreement and get that license. And it evolved into, you know, once we knew we had the power of a global brand, we knew that we could take it to, you know, more than a couple of countries. We knew that we could take it global. And what we then did was acquired additional brands to supply to the same watch distributors in all those countries globally, so that we had a much bigger offering, and also obviously we were able to then increase the turnover and the size of the orders from each distributor.
Tell me about getting that first international deal. Was that difficult?
Yes, I would say it was quite difficult. All international partnerships take work. I think difficult might be the wrong adjective. I think it's more a case of doing your research, making sure you partner with the right people. Mm. And once you've done that and you've established that relationship and you've established the rapport and you trust the people you're dealing with, the process is actually relatively easy.
So how did you go about working out who it was that you wanted to work with?
Right. So what we did was, there's a lot of ways about finding partners. And yeah, also there's different ways of doing business internationally. I mean, one way is of course, opening an office in every country you deal in, but that requires capital and staff, and it's a real logistical nightmare.
Yeah.
So you can choose to go with a distribution partner, and obviously it has an effect on pricing because there's an additional mouth in the food chain, so to speak, that needs to be fed. But you go about it by, you know, the main ways that we did it were exhibiting at international trade fairs, which we did every year. So, for example, we would exhibit at the Basel Watch Fair and the Hong Kong Watch Fair and the international duty-free show in Cannes in the south of France. And, you know, at Birmingham in England and all the watch fairs. But then there were other kind of guerrilla tactics that we used to employ, you know. For example, I know I'm giving away my secrets here, but you simply walk into a watch shop.
Yeah.
You buy a watch.
Yeah.
And you look at the warranty card and you see a list of all the distributors around the world, because the warranty card lists who to contact if there's a problem with your watch.
Yeah.
So you go into a shop, you buy a watch, you take it home, you open up the warranty card, and you email every distributor in you know, that's listed on the warranty card.
And that's what you did.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And that's how we actually secured our first customers, because
from the back of a warranty card.
Because you know, we could only afford to do those big trading exhibitions once we had revenue coming in. So we had to, you know, we had to use Google, we had to use, as I say, some guerrilla marketing tactics.
And I think that is a really great example of how you can start to work internationally even when you're very small, because a lot of people think, oh, I could never operate internationally, we just can't afford it, it's going to be really expensive, we'll need X, Y, and Z, and it's just beyond the reach of what we can manage. But you've just demonstrated for us really cleverly that that's actually not the case, and you can grow something really quite significant from, you know, almost from nothing.
Absolutely. You know, I think that a lot of people don't even consider international business because they believe that it's so complex, so costly, and so difficult to do. Whereas if you know, do your research properly and speak to a few people who have the experience in doing it, you'd actually realize that it's not that difficult. And if you have the drive and the motivation to make it work, it's really a lot less complex than it seems.
And so you have essentially come from South Africa with your family and the business partner and started over again in a whole new country with all those no networks and very little at your disposal, and essentially built a global brand from that point.
Yes, that is essentially what happened. However, I did move on from the watch business 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Again, a very interesting change, but again, international business. So I became basically the country manager of the Fackelmann Group.
Yes.
Which is the largest manufacturer of kitchen tools and gadgets in the world.
Yeah.
They make private label for 19 of the top 20 retailers in the world. Just as an example of what a, you know, an amazing organization it is.
Yeah.
And I ran the Australian subsidiary. And, you know, it involved far less international travel for me because I wasn't traveling to see customers, but I was still doing lots of travel on the sourcing side, going to Hong Kong and China and Thailand and, you know, various other countries, and also spending a lot of time in Germany with the head office, because it's always essential that that relationship is not only maintained, but you know, they do new product launches, you do demonstrations, and there would be, you know, twice a year we would all get together, all the 40 subsidiaries from around the world would get together for conferences where we would share intelligence and market knowledge and you know, explain to each other what works in each other's countries and feed off each other's ideas. So Again, very international and, you know, dealt with people from every country you can imagine.
Now, just talking about the number of places that you've been to, because it's fairly astronomical, I believe you've been to 180 cities in 36 countries in pursuit of international business deals. So I'd like to know, out of all the places you've been, what was your favorite place that you visited and why?
Sure. I'll answer that question first by saying that I don't sit and count the countries I've been to. It was, funny enough, an app that I found and downloaded. And just for fun, I actually went ahead and spent an hour or two and did it. And that was the number that it came up with. But look, it's a hard question to answer. Because every country and every city is so unique. But there are a few standouts. You know, I've got to say that I absolutely love going to Hong Kong and China. For the last 18 years, I've been going to Hong Kong and China at least, you know, 3 to 5 times a year, every year.
Yes.
And, you know, Hong Kong is this bustling melting pot of cultures from all over the world, and it just thrives 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It never sleeps. And what is so amazing is the cultural mix, because it's almost like, you know, we would always refer to it amongst ourselves as, like, you know, the New York of Asia. And because of the previous British mandate, being from South Africa, which was part of the British Commonwealth, and,
yes,
you know, there's a lot of similarities, yet it's an Asian country. So it's a fascinating place, and you learn a lot because the people who work there are just driven, and, you know, people work day and night, and, you know, you come back from a place like Hong Kong feeling energized. Similarly, China, you know, I've been visiting China for 18 years. The first time I went to China, I went to see our main watch supplier in a very small place called Zhuhai.
Zhuhai,
okay. It's about a 2-hour ferry ride from Hong Kong.
Right.
Now, when I went there for the first time, my supplier's factory was the only factory in Zhuhai, all right? It was a small little city. It had one highway from the port into the city, and I literally watched this city over a period of about 15 years, even less, within 10 years, grow to a complete metropolis with skyscrapers and 6-lane highways, and it went from one factory to 500 factories.
Wow, that's crazy, isn't it?
And I used to go there twice a year, and each time I stepped off the ferry, the city skyline had changed and doubled. And it was just incredible to witness the speed and the way it evolved, you know.
How did you find working in Zhuhai? What was it like to work with people in a city which, when you started in it, was at that the beginning of that journey of expansion? What was that like?
It was, again, relatively easy. The supplier who I was dealing with had been exporting for quite some time, so he had experience in global trade.
Yes.
You know, I suppose the hardest thing to get used to in those early days was the food.
Yeah.
Because, in those traditional areas of China, the cuisine is obviously completely different to westernized food.
Yes.
And food is a huge part of the Chinese culture. And I'll never forget the first dinner that the principal of the company, who's now a very good friend of mine, his name is Leo Chen. He took us to the best restaurant in Zhuhai.
Yes.
Expensive, fancy restaurant. And, the dishes start arriving, and it's pigeon and snake.
Right.
And shark fin soup, which you know, doesn't sit with me from a taste perspective or from a moral perspective, to be honest,
yeah.
You know. And, you know, he's like ordering all the most expensive dishes on the menu, and I'm looking at each and every one of them and thinking, wow, you know, do I just eat this and convince myself that I'm eating chicken, you know, or do I possibly insult him and not eat it? And those are some of the things you need to be aware about when doing international business.
So Tony, what did you do?
I ate it and convinced myself that I was eating chicken. You know, some, you know, in the pursuit of business, there are things you got to do sometimes, and you know, that was one of them.
Absolutely. So do you think that you have to love travel to be successful in international business? Is it a prerequisite?
I don't really think so. Well, firstly, I would say that I think generally most people do enjoy traveling, but I don't think you have to love traveling. There's always a certain amount of travel that's required, because what's most important, what is so key and critical in global trade, is the relationship with your global partners.
Yes.
And that relationship can only really be solidified when you're together.
Yeah.
Because while we have all these great technologies like Skype and FaceTime and video conferencing, where you can meet and it's like you're face to face, you know, you can conduct your business that way once you've established the relationship. But my suggestion would always be that you definitely make at least one trip, because also, you know, as I described, it's at the dinners and the lunches and when you're driving from store to store in the car together, where you speak about family and your interests and your life, and those are the things that build the relationship.
Absolutely.
And the things that are not discussed in the boardroom. And, you know, and that is what builds the relationship, creates the trust, and that leads to, you know, I almost call it the grease that makes the wheels run smoothly, is that relationship. Because when you run into problems and difficulty, if you've established that relationship, you're able to sort things out in a non-combative, easy manner. You know, particularly when you're on the other side of the world, things can be difficult to sort out, and you've different legislation and rules in different countries. And but if you have a good personal relationship with your partner, you know, it's much easier to generally work through any difficult issues that may arise.
And did you encounter many of those situations where you were working with partners who were on the other side of the world and things
absolutely,
blew up?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I could tell you 100 stories, you know.
Why don't you just give us your favorite one, or the most horrifying one?
let me think of a good one. So, setting up an international a distributor in another country.
Yes.
Containers on the water. Everything's been done. All the work's been done. And the customer or the distributor realizes that our watches have a 2-year manufacturing warranty, whereas the legislation in that country was that it had to be 3 years. Now, it was one of those things that neither he nor I checked. The goods were on the water, and he said to me, "I can't accept them. What do you do?" You know, it was a really, you know, difficult situation.
Yeah.
But we fixed it. You know, I said to him, "For your country, I'll offer you a 3-year warranty. I will reprint the warranty cards with 3-year warranty. You're going to have to repack, obviously, all the product when it lands, which I will pay for, because, you know, that's something I suppose I should have picked up." And yeah, essentially we solved the problem, but at the time there was complete panic.
Yeah.
Because we've got a full container on the ship, you know.
That's a lot of watches.
No, it's a lot of watches. And I'll tell you another brief one, which was a really difficult one. But again, it's an interesting story in what can go wrong is we landed a fantastic deal where we got a few watches listed in the British Airways in-flight magazine, duty-free magazine, and it was under the Speedo brand, and the one watch was an interesting shape, and they hadn't tested it properly, and we prided ourselves on superior waterproofing technology. And this one particular watch had a high defective rate, and there was like 8% defective rate of it not being water resistant to the right degree. And British Airways basically just cancelled the deal and sent us back, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of watches, which we had no one to sell them to. You know, and so those are some of the things that can go wrong.
Yeah.
But you know, you learn from every mistake, and you pick yourself up, and you carry on going. You know.
So I'm curious about the work that you did with the All Blacks, and I guess no Australian podcast interview would be complete without a question about the All Blacks. So what can you tell me about
that? I've got to say that was one of my most enjoyable and fascinating companies to work with. It was actually, I didn't work directly with the All Blacks, so we worked through a company called VBM, who were the company who controlled the licensing of the All Blacks brand. So we worked with them in conjunction with the New Zealand Rugby Union. We, in the same way as Speedo, we negotiated the rights to have the All Blacks watch license globally, and we made a range of watches, and you know, the All Blacks brand in New Zealand, and funnily enough, in other countries such as Japan, Argentina, and various other places, is really strong because the All Blacks are such a loved team.
Yeah.
So we weren't only selling All Black watches in New Zealand, we were selling them in other global markets. But one of the things that I'm most proud of is when New Zealand hosted the Rugby World Cup, the New Zealand Rugby Union wanted something really special, you know, for that period. And the watch supplier who I was chatting to about recently, Mr. Leo Chen, based in Zhuhai,
yes,
he was always very innovative, and he had just come up with what was called a USB watch, where there was a USB plug that connected to the watch, that fitted in the watch strap.
Yes.
And so you could just plug your watch into your computer.
Oh, wow.
And it acted, and it was exactly the same as a regular USB stick. So what we did was we downloaded all the information about the World Cup onto the watch before we took them to store. So we sent the factory all the information. So in other words, we had the timetable of all the matches, who was playing who, the groupings. We went so far as to list all the teams,
yeah,
all the players, the player biographies, you know, everything about, you know, the history of rugby, all that, you know, because we could fit, you know, I think at the time it was 128 megs or...
And this was all in the watch?
All in the watch,
so could you read this on your watch?
No, you had to plug it into your computer.
And then it...
And then you would open up you would the same way as when you plug in a USB, you would just go into you know, My Documents,
yep,
or whatever, and you would open the USB the little USB drive.
Yes.
And all the information was there for you.
So this is almost like a very early version of Apple Watch.
Yeah, I like to think that we were really ahead of the curve in that respect. I mean, yeah, we did a similar thing with Speedo watches,
yeah,
where we were preparing for the Olympics in Athens, and Speedo were launching the second version of the famous Farskin swimsuit.
Yes.
And they wanted a hero product, which is how they termed it, because that was just in a league of its own.
Yeah.
They wanted a hero watch that they could align with the swimsuit.
Yes.
And it had to be completely unique and you know, nothing available on the market.
Yes.
So we created a watch that was able to monitor your heart rate without a chest strap.
All right.
Now, for someone who's not in the watch industry, that may not sound like much, but at the time, you could only get heart rate monitors with a chest strap, and the chest strap spoke or communicated with the watch via an FM signal,
yes,
which doesn't work underwater.
Right.
So we had to come up with a technology where you could have your heart rate monitored without a chest strap, and we included things such as a stroke counter.
Yes.
So that you know, so that almost the same as like a pedometer today counts your footsteps.
Yes.
We had a stroke counter in the watch so that the athletes could monitor how many strokes per lap and that kind of thing, you know, and then of course we had to align the colors and the design and everything else, and that was another fantastic project that I really enjoyed. Yeah.
So this, your international journey has taken you to a lot of different places, and it's exposed you to so many different experiences. You went from watches then into the Fackelmann Group in cookware. What happened after that? So where did the journey take you next, and how did that happen?
Well, essentially where I'm at now is I've gained so much experience over my career in terms of product sourcing, brand management, international marketing, logistics, and just all those aspects of business that take a long time to learn, it's a lot of fighting through the trenches, should we say, to gain the knowledge. And I'm now in a position where I want to help other companies along that journey. And so I've moved into a business consulting environment where I assist companies not only with international expansion, but with, all functions of business.
Yeah.
I have a group of fantastic consultants that I work with. So depending on the requirements of each business, we work together to improve any part of the business, whether it be HR, sales, digital, marketing, etc. You know, so that's, I suppose, where the journey has led me to at this point.
Yeah. And was there something in particular that prompted you to, you know, to move into what you're doing now?
I wanted to travel a bit less. I have a young family. My daughter and my son are 10 and 12. And, 18 years of constant travel does take a toll. And also I was very interested in the challenge of a new career path.
Yeah.
I like to be, I like to wake up in the morning and feel challenged. I don't like to feel that I'm, running on automatic.
Yeah.
I was just looking for something new, and it almost evolved because I met various people through some networking groups that I'm a part of, and just through discussions and networking, this idea evolved into what it is. And
do you think you might take this business international?
I'm absolutely considering it. There's no doubt. You know, at this point, we're still in the early days of setting up in Australia. And it's a relatively new venture. I mean, we were only getting things up and running as we speak.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work yet to be done, but there is no doubt that I aim to take this international. I mean, as a good example, I have my entire family still live in South Africa, and I have a tremendous amount of business contacts in South Africa who could all benefit from these services.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a market that we plan to target first. You know, and take it from there and see how we can, you know, how we can develop. But international markets always are a goal for any business I'm involved in, because I just believe that you shouldn't limit yourself to one place, whether you're offering a product or a service, regardless, you know.
Yeah.
Generally, business needs and business requirements and consumers around the world have a lot of the same needs. And if you put your blinkers on and you just look at one country, you're really closing yourself off to so much opportunity that exists out in the world.
Now, lots of people who are listening to this might be thinking, oh, this just sounds kind of complicated and too hard. Is international business as difficult as it looks from the outside?
No, it really isn't. It really isn't. If you do your research, if you plan properly, if you have the right partners in place, and you don't dive in head first without going through a proper process, then it's really not difficult. It really isn't. I mean, you could almost think of it, if you're in product, for example, you know, it's easier to ship product to, and I'm really not kidding, okay? It's easier for me to export to New Zealand than it is to get product to Perth.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have more complications for some reason when I'm sending goods to, in my previous role, to my distributor in WA. It was harder. The logistics were more expensive and always having issues with the logistics. You know, whereas my distribution to New Zealand was easy as. So, you know, it really does seem harder than it is. But you can almost just look at it as, you know, you're shipping product. If you're shipping interstate, if you're shipping product from Sydney to Brisbane or to Melbourne,
yeah,
all you've got to do is add in a few extra steps and that product can go to anywhere on the face of the globe.
And suddenly you can reach millions more customers.
Exactly.
Than you could ever hope to reach if you were just selling whatever you sell at home.
Exactly. And again, with the technologies available, there's so many ways of going about it. You know, there are platforms like Amazon and Alibaba, and there's eBay, and you know, there's also all those types of online platforms that you can use. So, you know, it just takes also having the courage, I suppose, to reach out to the right people and get guidance,
mm,
and not to think that you know everything because you've been successful locally and you think to yourself, okay, well, I run a successful business here, so I can do it anywhere. You know, you need to reach out to people to get some advice, to get some guidance, to teach you about what's required. And once you do that, you know, it's really not that complicated.
So, Tony, to anyone thinking of expanding their business internationally, what would you say?
I would say absolutely go for it. I would say that if you're running a successful business and you are selling products and you're making good profits, there's no reason why you can't do it internationally. And one thing that us as Aussies, and I do consider myself an Aussie, yeah. even though I was born in South Africa, us as Aussies, we have a real competitive advantage. Number one, Australian brands are seen around the world. There's a perception that Australian brands are excellent quality, and it is global, and that is priceless. Number two, Australians themselves are seen as people of integrity mm-hmm. around the world. And people want to do business with Australians because we're seen as people with not only integrity, but people are fascinated by Australians. You know, you meet someone from Japan or from South America or from someone who's on the other side of the globe and you say you're from Australia. They're like, wow, Australia, no way. Have you ever seen a kangaroo? And, you know, they're like, people are just fascinated by Australia. And so straight away, the perception of quality product and the interest in the country, and straight away you've got a head start over a lot of other countries.
There's some rapport there before you even start to think about doing work together.
Exactly. You've got a head start on hundreds of other potential people in other countries doing what you're doing, you've got a head start on those people.
And what about for the people who are listening who are not from Australia, because this podcast is broadcast on the internet and so people from anywhere can listen to it.
Sure.
What about people from other places?
Well, I mean, my advice is the same really, is that, you know, if you run a successful business locally and you do your research, and the research, again, is not that hard to do. So, you know, take, for example, kitchenware, as I was in. You know, say you're running a successful distribution, you have your own brands and you successfully distribute them to customers and you live in Russia, for example.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's no reason why you can't take your brands, if they sell well and they're competitive, and sell them internationally. Now, the only thing that you, I suppose, need to consider is that, again, doing your homework, you need to research the markets. You need to make sure that if you have a distributor selling on your behalf, that your product is competitive. So, but thanks to good old Google, that information is so easy to find.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy. All you do is, if you, you know, this gentleman, you know, who owns a company in Russia, and you're considering exporting to Poland, for example, you know, you go and search for Polish retailers and look at on Polish websites at the RRPs or what the e-commerce websites are selling the like-for-like products at. And you've got the information. You do your numbers and you say, yes, you know, my distributor can buy it for X, he can land it for Y. This will be his margin. We're competitive. And then you can go about looking for a distribution partner. The other thing which is growing, which is an important point today, is that you don't always have to look for a distribution partner. In many countries, I used to supply direct to the retailer. If the retailer is big enough, the likes of a David Jones or a Walmart or
Neiman Marcus.
yeah, I mean, there's millions of, not millions, but there's thousands of retailers around the world who in a particular country would have 200-300 stores. Now, if you're supplying them directly, the product is much more competitive because you're cutting out the distributor, so your sales volume is incredible. And now what's happening is a lot of retailers are now themselves attending all the international trade fairs because they want to buy direct from suppliers.
Yeah, instead of going through a middleman.
Correct. Because the world has become so competitive, because retailers are backing against the likes of Amazon and you know, and all these other global brands and so on, the retailers are looking for ways to make themselves more competitive. Otherwise, they will not survive.
So speaking of platforms like Amazon, I mean, Amazon arrived in Australia last week and opened operations in Australia last week. What do you think that's going to do to the Australian retail scene? And does that mean that Australian producers and Australian brands really need to be looking internationally?
Yes. I think that Amazon will most certainly, without any shadow of a doubt, have an impact, and a large impact, on Australian retailers. It's just been proven in every other country that Amazon has entered. You know, Amazon can make losses in Australia for 10 years, and it probably wouldn't equal what Jeff Bezos earns in 1 month of interest.
Wow.
On his value, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
You know, and that's their model.
Yeah.
They come into the country, they sell product at a loss, they gobble up market share, retailers fall over, and once they have enough market cap, they put their prices yeah. up and they make money.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can lose money for however long they want. They're sitting on so much cash that it's like a pinprick in the ocean for them.
Yes.
So retailers really need to be, you know,
thinking bigger.
Wary. They need to understand, look, there's always going to be a place for for standard traditional shopping in malls and retail outlets, but you know what we talk about these days is obviously it's omnichannel. You know, you need to have a good online presence and you need to have a good presence in your physical store, and if you can do that and combine them, and things like click and collect and a whole lot of other different technologies which are available to retailers, then you know you can compete, because people don't only shop based on price. I mean, a lot of people do, but if you want to buy a nice Hugo Boss suit, are you going to buy it online? Maybe some people would take a chance and do it, but I would, if I'm going to be buying a Hugo Boss suit, I'm going to be going to David Jones, and I'm going to have it measured properly, and you know, cut to fit, and you know, so there's always going to be a place where service is required.
Yes.
And people also, quite frankly, enjoy the shopping experience.
Yeah.
It's more of a social, you know, people go to malls, they meet for lunch, they spend time with their friends, they walk past a shop, they go inside. So you know,
it's also about an experience, not just a purchase of a good.
And retailers who are good at facilitating that in-store experience are the ones that will continue to be profitable. You know, a great example of that is a company that I used to work for in my early career, a company called Digital Music Express, also a global brand, has operations all over the world, and what the company does is the same way as you have a like a Foxtel box in your home, or that you view your cable television with. We used to put these boxes into, for example, hotels who require music in 25 different parts of their business. So they need elevator music in the elevators, they need pop music in the bar, they need classical music in the reception area, and so on and so on. And we would create playlists specific to all the areas that were required, and you can apply the same thing to retail. So what we would do is we would create playlists based on the demographic of when certain people are in the store. So you would know that between, say, 9 and 3, it would generally be mums and bubs maybe younger teenagers, and you would create playlists that suit that demographic.
Yeah.
You know, then from like say 3 to 5 or 7, where it's maybe a more of a mix of business people and people picking things up on the way home from work and so on. You know, you adjust the playlist to meet that demographic, and it goes as far as smell. You know, it's all the senses, and you know, the stores that are able to manage that whole experience are obviously the ones that have less to fear from the likes of Amazon.
Yeah. Tony, it's been great having you on the show today. We've covered a really wide range of topics, and I've loved hearing some of the stories you've had to share. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that? Is there a web address that they can go to?
Yeah, sure. Look, I suppose the easiest way is via my LinkedIn profile. Which you know, if you just search for Tony Jacobson Sydney on LinkedIn, I'm the first. I'll be the first one that pops up, and all my contact details are there. So that's probably the best thing to do. Yeah, I welcome anybody to contact with me. I like to say that I'm a serial networker. You know, I reach out to everybody, and I welcome people to reach out to me, so that would be fantastic.
That's great. So folks, if you want to get in touch with Tony wherever you are in the world, just head over to his LinkedIn profile, Tony Jacobson Sydney, and hit him up, and I'm sure he'll write back to you. Again, Tony, thanks so much for being on the show today, and I look forward to having you back here again sometime soon.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Cynthia.